Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. I'm Liz Martin Silverstone and you're listening to episode 111 on diversity in paleontology. This episode is a little bit different from our usual episodes and something that we've been considering and thinking about for some time. In fact, these interviews were recorded back in October at SVP in Australia off the backs of the Women in Paleo workshop and the Diversity Luncheon. For a number of reasons, such as me taking a full-time job, Dave going back on the rigs, where he was until very recently, hence why you just have me today, and the global pandemic, this episode has taken a little bit longer than we would have liked to put out. Given the recent events and anti-racism activism around the world, we thought that this was probably a good time to push and get this episode finished. This episode was produced with permission and in conjunction with the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology and focuses on diversity in paleontology and the many different facets of diversity. I sat down to discuss being transgender in paleontology with Jan Nasif, women in paleontology with Thaisa Rodriguez and Femke Hallwerda, racial diversity with Gabriel Santos, and what SVP is actually doing to try to combat these issues and understand them with Jessica Theodore, who's the vice president of SVP and oversees the diversity committee. Although the focus is on SVP, these issues are definitely not limited to vertebrate paleontology and are relevant to paleontology as a whole. We really wanted to provide a medium to discuss these issues and learn so that we can all do better in the future. We at PaleoCast think that diversity in all forms is an important part of paleontology. It allows us to see the field from a range of different views and ensure inclusiveness, and this can only benefit the science. This is why we all fight for diversity and inclusivity. Elsa has written articles about the image problem in paleontology. We recently recruited Vish Venkat, PhD student of Indian origin, and Dave is now better recognizing his privilege and continually working towards self-improvement. Personally, I mostly shout a lot on the internet about all things equality, but mainly about women in paleo and women in science. We know that we need to do better, and we're really trying to focus on that now. We at PaleoCast pledge to seek out more diverse interviewees so that we can amplify their voices. If anyone has an idea for episodes or people that we can interview, please get in touch. Now, we've previously received some very negative feedback from a minority of people when we've discussed issues related to equality in the past. We know that this episode will probably cause a similar backlash, but here we discuss what being a paleontologist is like for different groups. To whom privilege is accustomed, equality can feel like oppression. We will continue to push for equality and do what we can to help. We would like to thank the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology for cooperating with us on this episode and speaking with us, and to our interviewees for opening up about sometimes very difficult questions. As always, we have some images to go along with this episode, so please make sure you have a look at our website. Finally, please share this episode widely, not for our sake, but to get the message out and to encourage discussion. We hope you enjoy it. Okay, so I'm sitting down now with Jan. So thank you for sitting down with me, Jan. Can you introduce yourself and say kind of why I've sat down with you today?
Yes, I can, Liz. I'm happy to be here. So my name is Jan Nasif. I am a PhD candidate at Ohio University. I'm doing my dissertation work on the evolution of the middle ear sound conduction system in reptiles, birds, and dinosaurs. And I am here with Liz talking today because I served as a participant in the Diversity in Paleontology luncheon, talking about my experiences as a open trans woman and lesbian in vertebrate paleontology.
Yeah, so again, thank you so much for actually talking about these issues with me. And I'm glad that I have been able to, you know, find some people that I can sit down with, because I think this is a really important thing. So thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that there's a lot of good faith effort to increase diversity and to promote inclusion, as well as addressing issues of accessibility and in paleontology. But it still requires a lot of effort on the part of these marginalized groups to sort of bridge that gap. And so it's nice that people who consider themselves to be allies are helping to meet us in the middle.
Yeah. So what kind of things have you kind of seen, like, at this meeting or at past meetings that are sort of helping to bring this issue forward and to maybe change things in the right direction?
So I think that events like the symposium or the workshop for women in paleontology, which was at this meeting, unfortunately, I heard a lot about it. I was not able to attend, unfortunately, but also that but also the luncheon itself are good first steps. Because it allows people who are most directly affected by these concerns and by these issues to speak directly to members of the governance of SVP, of Society of Vertebrate Paleontology, and sort of confront what the state of those concerns is, whether or not they're being addressed, because so much of the, I just lost my train of thought. I'm sorry, I should cut this out. but so often, there's a lot of work behind, that's being done behind the scenes, but it's not being necessarily effectively communicated to the people who are directly affected. SVP governance has been working to reform the code of conduct. That has been one of their primary concerns, but they've also taken other steps in terms of changing and updating the demographic information on their website so that you can now identify as whatever gender you would like, including multiple genders should you so choose, or self-described, which is excellent. I was very pleasantly surprised by that. Or having accessibility of pronoun stickers for name tags so that people may use those, and having access to gender-neutral facilities or unisex facilities. However, one of the things that is an ongoing concern is that these steps, although they are positive and they are much appreciated, aren't always necessarily clearly communicated to the people who need it. And so a lot of this takes place through word of mouth, unfortunately. And that's been the case in the past, and it's starting to get better. But even the events that are directed towards, for example, LGBT community members, such as the dinner, which took place last night, it was really fun, is basically passed through word of mouth. Shout out to Margo Nelson and Mark Ewan for organizing it. It's a great opportunity just to sort of engage with other members of the community in a safe space and just relax and just network with people who have had similar experiences and just have fun and without feeling like you have to account for your own identity. But it was in the program, which is great, but it's still going to take some time in order to normalize it to the point at which everybody is aware of it, and everybody has access to these resources when they need them.
Yeah. So speaking of that, you talk about it being word of mouth. So I've seen the stickers, but I actually have no idea where they've come from. I assumed it was at the luncheon, and so I kind of missed the boat on that.
But so it actually wasn't. So yeah, I didn't find out about it until just before the luncheon, actually. So I can't remember who it was who came up to me and mentioned it. But so they were at the registration table on the side. Yeah. And
they,
you register.
Completely missed them.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, and that's, I did too. They're off on the side. I went over later and got them, and the people, people are happy to do it. They have tons of them. They were sort of in that space around the poster session, which is great. But you register, and they just, you know, obviously the volunteers don't necessarily know that they're there. They don't necessarily know that they are supposed to communicate that to every person. And so, and that's honestly one of the sort of bigger issues when it comes to normalizing pronoun disclosure in paleontology, is that it's sort of considered this niche accessibility issue where you have it available if you need it, rather than trying to integrate it more fully into the way that we communicate science and the way we engage with other people professionally. So often it comes up to just the presence of a queer member or genderqueer member of the community to sort of be the guinea pig and have to disclose the pronouns they prefer, rather than having it so normalized that it doesn't feel out of place and they feel like they're welcomed, rather than feel like they're sort of imposing this construct which everybody has onto the normal situation. And so if it makes sense to just have stickers for everybody available to use, it makes sense to put it on slides for PowerPoints, makes sense to integrate it more fully so that we feel like we're welcome and we don't feel like the only reason that it's taking place at all is to account for ourselves.
So do you have any kind of sense like how paleontology is different from maybe other sciences, or?
That's a really interesting question. And it's something I have been thinking about a lot. And I don't necessarily have a good answer, unfortunately.
Yeah,
I think that there are some aspects that make it difficult for queer paleontologists that may not necessarily present themselves in other areas of science. For example, but they may not necessarily be specific to queer scientists. For example, issues with accessibility of resources in the field.
Yeah.
So often field research is conducted in areas that are fairly remote or areas that may be more rural and politically conservative.
Yeah.
And so it can be challenging to for people and intimidating to try to enter those communities and express themselves and be comfortable and be productive as academics when they when they're in constant fear for their lives or just don't have the resources that they need. I know this is the case for other groups as well. I know that, and of course, there is the continuing sort of stereotype of this sort of masculine image of paleontology, which I think SVP and other organizations are doing well to dismantle. And I think that, it's moving in the right direction, but there's still a lot of work that can be done. And there's so many aspects to being queer and being trans that are sort of hidden in basic mental health that are not necessarily obvious to other community members. And so sometimes it feels like you're basically working the entire time with lead weights on your feet, and being able to actually express yourself fully allows you to be a productive member of the community and to be successful and to be maintain your curiosity and maintain and get through graduate programs and get through early stages of your career and even just move into the field itself. I think it's also challenging as paleontologists. We are biologically minded. And so I have not personally encountered this, but I know people who have, have some familiarity with sexual determination and gender identity, but see it as something that's sort of outside the realm of science or understand and try to diagnose and categorize people in ways that make sense to them because that's what they're used to doing for their science. You have these very discrete diagnoses and categories.
Putting things into boxes.
We love, as humans, we just really like putting things in boxes. And it's important for people to understand. This is one of the things I tried to emphasize while I was talking to people at the luncheon, is that none of this is resolved and that these terms that people use are completely self-identified, and they may mean different things to different people. What it means to be bisexual may mean completely different things. Well, not completely, but different things to two people that are in the same room. It may being genderqueer, being non-binary, being trans. These categories are all fairly fluid. Gender isn't just a spectrum; it's this n-dimensional like hypervolume, and so is sexuality. And so it becomes difficult for people who are very scientifically minded sometimes to engage with that because they feel like they have to sort of understand all of it or understand none of it. And it can be dismissive of it. And I think it's important for people to understand that nobody understands how this works. There is still an active area of debate, and it's okay to mess up, and it's okay to be confused and to be unaware of it. But it's important to be able to engage with it and listen to people when they tell you what they are and to believe them. And so, and that comes back to pronoun use as well. And to try to normalize that. And I think that people are getting better, but there's still quite a ways to go. Because you will mess up. I've messed up. There are areas where I have said some things that were fairly dismissive or fairly hurtful to people, and I have had to account for that. And it's just a matter of being better and doing better.
So just kind of to wrap up, get to last question that I want to ask you. What do you think that we as a community can do? If you could think of like one really important thing that we can do as a community to make this better.
Oh boy.
Not necessarily one.
So this is, okay. So there are a few things that I could think of that might be just sort of good starting points. And the first thing, as I said before, is to listen to people when they come to you with their concerns, to normalize these sorts of basic accommodations. When somebody says they've been hurt by something that you said or something that somebody else has said, address it, take charge of what you've done in the past. Admit that it's okay to make mistakes. And if you see something that is potentially hurtful, call it out. And that's not to say that you have to be aggressive, but just simply to pull somebody aside and talk to them about and help them understand how what they have done or what they have said might be toxic or might be hurtful and damaging to the people that are around them. And because it's possible that they just don't understand. It's not necessarily made in bad faith. Because a lot of these issues aren't intuitive unless you're already members of these communities. As well, and it's many of the issues that queer people face professionally in academia are invisible or take place at the personal level. Mm. And they may not necessarily be disclosed to other members of the other academics. Many people are unwilling or reticent to enter and disclose that information in academia as a result of that, because in many cases, people have been rejected or abandoned by loved ones, by family yeah. members, by partners, by friends. And so they are understandably incredibly reticent to express themselves, and they may be facing other issues in terms of medical transitioning or insurance. And those accommodations are invisible that they also might be having to balance with the demands of being a professional academic. And additionally, this is an issue in the United States specifically. I cannot speak to the experiences of other countries or the laws in other countries. But right now, there is a move being made by groups to limit the ability for recourse in workplace harassment, workplace inequity, and in hiring bias, and right to work for mm-hmm. queer people. There were just at the time of recording a few days ago, there were three Supreme Court cases that were heard regarding whether or not it is legal to discriminate against LGBT members, specifically two gay men and a trans woman, in the workplace. Mm. And so institutions, obviously universities have personalized codes of conduct and rules regarding this, but institutions need to make it clear and need to make it visible that that is unacceptable.
Yeah.
And that at institutional level, that it is not permitted for that type of systemic bigotry and marginalization and to take place, to let yeah. people know that they are secure and they are safe in those communities, and that they are not at risk of repercussions just for being who they are.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Lots of work still to do, but at least things are starting to change.
Yeah. It's nice. I only came out recently. For people who might've met me at a different conference, I looked a little bit different. But I have personally, I know other people have as well. When I conducted a short survey, said that they had personally felt welcome and they felt like they were a member of the community. But it's important to understand that not everybody feels that way.
Yeah.
But I think that there really is, like I said before, a desire by allies to make it a safe space.
Yeah.
And to increase the presence of gender divergent sexual minorities in the field. And it's just going, and as diversity increases, it is just going to get more complicated.
Yeah.
And so if people can start listening now and start trying to understand things that we go through, it's only going to get better.
Great. Well, thank you again, John, for speaking with me. I really appreciate it. And hopefully, well, now we've got some ideas of how us, especially like me as an ally, how I can move forward and kind of make things a bit better for those who need it.
Thank you so much, Liz. It was fun. It was nice to see you.
Yeah, great. So today I'm sitting down with Teresa Rodriguez and Femke Holwerda about the Women in Paleo workshop, because they made this awesome workshop the other day talking about issues in women in paleo. So if you guys want to kind of introduce yourself and what made you come up with the idea for this workshop.
Oh, sure. I'm a paleontologist from Brazil. Mm-hmm. I specialize mostly on pterosaurs. And 2 years ago, I was invited to give a roundtable on women paleontology back home. And we discovered so many things that were totally wrong and unacceptable. And ever since, I began just doing other talks and giving more workshops. And then I knew Femke was also doing the same thing in Europe. So we decided just to join efforts and do something for SBP where we can have more visibility.
Right, yeah. So I'm a paleontologist from the Netherlands. I'm now in Edinburgh and I work on sauropods. And like Teresa, I just started doing a workshop, very much testing the waters, seeing mm-hmm. what would come up and if it would be appreciated or not. But it's been very popular. And we actually decided to start doing it after Trump was elected. And then, yeah, me and Teresa quickly hooked up and joined efforts because I think it's important to...
Yeah,
to join that. Yeah.
I guess kind of starting out, big question, but like, is paleontology a level playing field?
So I think, yeah, yes and no. I think there are so many layers to it. I think in essence, everybody wants to have everything equal. Mm. And but yeah, there are lots of subtle things that are not right. And it's difficult to pinpoint sometimes what exactly it is. And then it becomes almost an ethereal subject. But I think as soon as you talk to especially women about it, then they're all like, yes, that's exactly right.
Yeah. So
sometimes things are not that subtle, but they are invisible.
Mm. Yes.
So there's a lot of things women don't like talking about. They don't like to expose themselves. They want to show that they are strong and independent and capable within academy. And that's the thing. Sometimes they're bettering things by themselves.
Yeah. I guess it's tricky with all of the stereotypes that you think of, you know, what is a paleontologist and what we see as everything in media of what a paleontologist is, and you're trying to be tough and be like, I can do this, and it's hard to actually see everything underneath. Can you talk a little bit about sort of these stereotypes and
anything? There are so many things, but let's just think about Jurassic Park, for instance.
Mm.
So we have two paleontologists in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the man is the savior of the children. He fights the dinosaurs.
He's the main expert as well.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And then there's this great woman paleontologist. And she's like a paleobotanist because, you know, it's more appropriate for women to study plants because they're cuter. And then she does something on the movie that people don't expect. She goes through this huge pile of feces. And that's all. She doesn't contribute really to saving the children, saving the park, you know.
Yeah.
She has some action things. But that's all. And this really happens here for our daily lives as well.
Yeah,
because people don't expect to see a female PI, for instance, or a woman who's leading a field trip as well.
Yeah, no, I agree. And I think in the workshop I showed the last film that actually had a leading female paleontologist today that really strongly impressed on me, which was Baby, Secret of the Lost Legend, where there's somehow a brontosaurus stuck in the jungle of Africa. But the main person is a female paleontologist, and she has to defy her male PI because he keeps telling her she's wrong, and she knows she's right, and she goes after these sauropods, and her boyfriend has to run after her. And but that's like 1985 or something. It's that long ago.
Ever since.
Yeah, and since then, I think in film and in books.
In real life as well.
Yeah, it's getting better though. I mean, there are like a lot of efforts to turn the stereotype around. But I think also what we found in our workshop is that you have to start really young because from age 6 onwards, like the stereotyping becomes so embedded in our subconsciousness.
Yeah.
That even I remember when I was a kid that, you know, that sort of riddle of the doctor who, like a father and a son, they crash in a car and the father dies and then the son gets taken to the hospital and the doctor says, I can't operate, this is my son. And then the riddle is, who's the doctor? And I remember when I was a kid, everybody was like, don't know. And of course, the doctor is the mother. And it's like, so that starts really young. So I think it's good to kind of try to turn that around.
Those small things, they are very present in our everyday lives.
Yeah.
So I began as a professor at a very young age. And I heard several times colleagues and students tell me I don't look like a professor.
Oh, yeah.
So that's totally unfair. And sometimes I just think I should dress up.
Yeah.
But then I look at my colleagues and they're like wearing shorts and t-shirts.
Yeah.
And people don't ever question them.
Yeah.
So that's really unfair.
Yeah. The thing I think is really interesting is it's kind of related to starting early and what things girls versus boys are interested in, but also just looking at topics within paleontology. So just now I've been sitting in the theropod section, and in the first 8 talks, there was one woman. And oh, I think in the second set of 8, there is one woman.
Oh, man.
And it's just...
It's the male panel.
Yeah, you see in things like the mammals, you get a lot more women, and then theropods.
Yeah.
No.
Yes, all these things are stereotypes.
Yeah.
There is no logical explanation why we have more women in mammals than with reptiles.
Yeah.
It's all stereotypes, and they're just pervasive. They begin when we are very, very young, and they just continue our whole lives.
Yeah, because I think the only time when I had a sauropod symposium with lots of female presenters was when I organized a symposium together with another female paleontologist, Veronica Diaz, and then we had, you know, more.
Oh, there's the thing. Did you get to invite your speakers?
Yes.
No, that's the thing. Normally, when speakers are invited, if the organizer is a man, they normally just invite other men and then perhaps a staple woman.
Yeah.
And when women do this, they invite more women and men in equal parts.
Yes.
So it's one of the problems we discussed actually at the workshop, how this network of collaborations work. So normally, and many people don't actually see this, but men usually collaborate more with other men as well. And this is very hurtful for us.
Yeah.
I mean, for our size, we're being excluded for all things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess kind of moving forward, how can we go about addressing these stereotypes and what can we do?
I think awareness is really good because I sometimes have to double check myself as well. It's like, no, you're thinking in a stereotype again because it's so pervasive. So awareness and normalization. I think that was you who said, Thaisa, that if you add, is it 30% of a minority, then it becomes a statistical sort of normalization process? Was it you? Was it somebody else who told me that?
I guess.
So if you kind of, you just have to be tenacious about addressing it until it comes to a certain point where, you know, it's no longer a stereotype anymore. Mm. But it's quite hard. You need to be quite,
Yes, that's why we had to organize the workshop here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who still think that this kind of conversation doesn't belong in our field.
Yeah.
And there's no other way to make people more aware of this problem. Unless, you know, of course, talking about it.
Yeah.
We cannot be silent. We cannot afford to be silent at this moment.
Yeah.
So this kind of conversation, the diversity luncheon, the Women in Paleontology workshop, they are part of our field. So we have to use our spaces within the conferences to talk about it and raise awareness. Of course, we had so very few men attend the workshop, so perhaps awareness is not working, but they have seen that we have discussed this subject.
Yeah.
So perhaps in the near future, they will become more and more aware and will just stick to keep talking about it.
Yeah, because people are still talking about it, I think, throughout the conference outside of the workshop. So that helps, I think, a lot to, hopefully the next year, you know, more people will come. Yeah.
Oh, are going to do this next year again? Yes.
Sorry.
I guess kind of wrapping up, final question is, are you guys hopeful about how things are going? Do you think it's improving?
Yeah.
I think among the young men, definitely.
Definitely,
I think in EAVP, especially... because I've got more experience with the workshop in EAVP, you see more and more men coming and saying, yes, okay, this is a problem and we want to help. What can we do? Which is really positive, I think.
Yeah.
Because I also don't want them to feel like we're constantly attacking the male population within paleontology.
We're not attacking them, but we just want to be heard.
Yeah.
And I think It's very, we have had some positive outcomes, yes. In Brazil, we actually began like our small revolution. So no, we talk about it. And then this year, we're going to have both roundtables on women in paleontology and LGBTQ issues. So it's an improvement. We're going to talk about those things, about minorities within the conference. And for SVP, I think SVP is one of the few societies that's actually ahead of the others. I'm very pleased to hear about the new things that's going to be improved on the code of conduct.
Yeah.
And yes. Also new ways to help bring families to SVP, yes. Especially women with small children.
Yeah, I've heard from Jessica Theodore already about a lot of the things moving forward with family rooms and help. I mean, we're literally sitting in the family room right now and helping with childcare at future meetings, which is going to be fantastic.
As people, women with young kids just being able to attend. So I think that's really good. Yeah,
and I was super happy to see at this conference so many children here. Yes. It was great. Really, people are bringing their families, you know, and having a family and having a job or doing research should not be exclusive.
It's especially with a conference so far away and people have turned it into a little family holiday and stuff. It's great that it's they can do that and still attend the conference. Well, great, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you for the invitation.
So I'm sitting down now with Gabe Santos at SVP. I guess we can start out by introducing yourself, if you can kind of tell me who you are.
Sure. So my name is Gabriel Santos. I am the Collections Manager and Outreach Coordinator at the Raymond Alf Museum of Paleontology in Southern California. I used to do more paleontological research. My master's thesis was on Eocene mammals of California, and I did a project on marine mammals known as desmostylians. But lately, I've shifted career focus and focusing more on education now.
Cool. So you were heavily involved in the diversity luncheon, or you were part of the, I guess, the panel at the luncheon. Can you talk a bit about what your involvement is with the diversity luncheon and what you're doing in that?
Yeah. So as part of the diversity luncheon, I was invited to be one of the discussion leaders at the table. I was working with my friend and colleague, Kanto. She and I were part of the discussion of how to support people of color at the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology. So we were both happy to do that. For me, it was very important because I am Filipino American, first generation scientist in my family. Mm-hmm. The representation of Filipinos or even Southeast Asian in vertebrate paleontology is in the United States is not very strong, but even globally, there isn't very much of a representation there. And just from both of our backgrounds, we were very honored to be part of the discussion on how to support people of color or even just people of diverse backgrounds within the society.
You know, and there's obviously a kind of stereotype diversity issue when you think of a paleontologist. So how do you kind of deal with that? And have you had to deal with that issue before with people going, what, you're a paleontologist?
Yeah, I've definitely had that happen quite a few times, like especially when I do outreach events. Mm. I can remember a time specifically where I was at an event and, you know, they had, this is our guest paleontologist, Gabe Santos. They had my name there. Mm. I had a name badge on and I was up on stage talking and some people came up after. They didn't attend the show, so they didn't see, but they came after and walked right up to me and asked like, oh, which one is the paleontologist? I like to speak with them. And then they're like, is it the people over there? And there were some people dressed up in lab coats and stuff like that. And they were asking, are those the paleontologists? I was like, no, that's me actually. Yeah. So it's happened quite a few times. And but also coming from Los Angeles, it's not as much as some other people may face in other parts of the world. And on the flip side of things also, it's not a lot of things that I've kind of dealt with is culturally, there aren't a lot of Filipino paleontologist or mm-hmm. a scientist for that matter, just, you know, for a lot of many different reasons. So I also try to work with breaking the stereotype of I can't be a paleontologist because this is not in my culture or my background.
Yeah.
So it comes from both sides for sure.
You mentioned before the work you were doing at the luncheon was about how to support people from minorities in paleontology. Can you talk a bit about what you can do, what is out there in terms of options of supporting people and getting people into the field?
Yeah. So one of the, we decided that we would focus on solutions, how to support people who are coming into the field for sure. Khan was speaking more from just smaller things to help make academia and places where paleontology is a part of more inclusive. And I was trying to discuss things on a broader scale, mm-hmm. How to support a wide international community. Mm-hmm. So some of the things we had talked about were like starting a mentorship program for people it's their first time at SVP and they come from an underrepresented or underserved area in the world, you know, mm-hmm. where paleontology isn't common, and they could find a mentor at SVP and help make their very first conference a lot more welcoming, have a feeling of being part of the community instead of coming in and being very intimidating and daunting. I know for sure my first SVP was very daunting. And I definitely at the first start didn't feel very like I belonged very mm-hmm. well. Luckily I met some great people who helped me feel like I'm part of the society in the beginning. And I know that there are other societies that do this, like the Geological Society of America does a really great one. So that's one way we had discussed that. Another we had thought about was trying to reconsider the way we choose where SVP is being held. Mm. For many reasons, SVP is very Western-centric or even mm-hmm. U.S.-centric. Yes, the majority of our members do come from the United States, but we are an international society. So we had discussed ideas on how we can make it either easier for people from other countries to come to the conference that when it's held in the United States, or even maybe making it where international happens more often, because, you know, here in Australia, even this is the first time many people have been able to attend SVP, mm. especially for younger grad students or early career people, just because going anywhere can be pretty expensive if you're international. Mm. And, you know, even with some of the things happening politically in the US,
yeah.
it's difficult for a lot of people to get visas to yeah. even come and attend the conference. So it was just being mindful of those kind of things. Some other stuff we had brought up ideas for were like, you know, developing kind of a safe space, quiet room mm-hmm. where people can get away from the conference if they need to, that's got a designated, the safe volunteer where they can come and feel comfortable discussing any issues that arise mm-hmm. while they're at SVP, where, it, you know, they feel like they don't have to be out in the open to discuss that. Yeah, those were some of the ideas that we had.
All of those are kind of SVP meeting focused.
Yeah.
Are there other kind of things that we can do moving forward just generally as a community to encourage people in and make people feel more comfortable?
Yeah, some other things that we talked about were, you know, when you're doing outreach events or things like that, or trying to bring people into your lab, consider their background mm. more carefully. Not carefully is the word I'm saying, just be more mindful
yeah.
of it, right? So, you know, if let's say you have someone coming in and they're not drinking, they don't do drinking, or being mindful of where you have your meetings, what kind of food you even mm-hmm. decide to offer. Those are little things that can vary between people's backgrounds. We were even discussing things like if you're doing outreach events and you're trying to show that paleontology is a viable option as a career, have your signage in multiple languages or things mm. like that when you are posting those, emphasizing making a better effort in finding diverse voices if you're mm-hmm. doing panels, podcasts, things like that. even being mindful of how you look for co-authors, right? A lot of times we work, you know, that's how it is. You work with who you know,
yeah.
And because that's fair, it's comfortable. But if you are looking, try to find authors who may be in another country or from that may not be as recognizable, but you know, it may be a great chance for them to have work or
mm-hmm.
even reconsidering the way that you do dispersing work, right? If you want someone and you think, oh, this would be a great project for them to be lead author, make sure you give them, help them take the initiative
mm.
to do the work to be lead author. And that way it can give them that kind of push they need that otherwise they may not have gotten that chance from. Letting people know about all these different types of funding sources and things
mm-hmm.
like that, that, you know, they're definitely out there, but for some people, it's just hard. I mean, for a lot of us, it's hard to know what is out there without the help of it, right? So, you know, being mindful of that kind of stuff. It's definitely a very large concept to and complicated subject
yeah.
that we're trying to figure out. And it's been a cool thing to have this discussion forum where we can figure out solutions
yeah.
and not just be discussing the same issues over and over, but really trying to make an effort to move forward with the society.
Yeah. One of the things that I've actually talked to friends about is I have a lot of friends who are physicists, and obviously they're mostly guys, and they're trying to encourage girls to get into physics.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I'm kind of like, that's great, but you're also a guy. So what people need is role models.
Mm-hmm.
But then how do you approach that if, for example, you want to do an outreach event, but there isn't somebody of a minority that you can, you know, come and do the outreach, and you're trying to say it's open to everybody, but then you still have this panel of all white people.
Yeah.
And it's like, how do you kind of, what's the best way of getting around that and trying to show that we might all be white, but we're open to everybody, even if we can't show it to you right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's 2019. We have digital technologies that are super easy.
Yeah.
Like do a Skype in session with somebody, right?
Yeah.
Have a special session where you can Skype in someone and they could talk about their stuff. My good friend in California, they do talks digitally all the time. They Skype in people from all over the world and from different backgrounds so that they can show. And it's, you know, it's important to bring in your local for sure, because that has a whole
yeah.
different demographic of people that you want to make sure that you're hitting, that you're getting, that you're outreaching to. But you can definitely do digital things, Skyping in, or even just having little signs where you're like, here's these people, this is their work. Having that up there for people to see really goes that you're, to, I mean, really does a lot to show that there are other people outside of their local community who
mm-hmm.
are working on these things, who are paleontologists, and you're doing even just that small bit to have recognition and representation of people. You know, I understand it's difficult to fly people, right? It's
yeah.
expensive, but even a picture with a little blurb spread in other places, like here are paleontologists doing these kind of things.
Yeah.
It can really go a long way, especially for someone who may not see themselves represented on that panel. They're walking through and they see a name and a face.
Yeah.
That little thing could be a lot for them to go online and learn more about this person, contact them and see like, okay, there's one person like that. That's cool. Maybe
yeah.
I could be the next person.
Cool.
So, you know, it's thinking innovatively and outside the box of beyond just like, how can I get them here? It,
yeah.
It's like, how can I represent someone here who may not be able to be here? So.
Do you think that the field is improving in terms of equity and, you know, getting things to be a bit more diverse and.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely moving forward.
Yeah.
I mean, everyone has opinions on the speed at which it could be moving for sure, but we can't go back and say it's not moving forward. We definitely, I mean, even from my first SVP to
mm-hmm.
the one today, the diaspora of people has definitely changed. You know, I'm seeing and meeting so many people now from all different backgrounds that I don't remember meeting at my very first SVP. And so many more people's voices are being heard now, which I think is great. Yeah, I definitely think we're moving forward. I think, yes, there's still a lot of work to do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that either. It's like, whoa, we can do a lot more
yeah.
to to make things equitable. Because I think we're very much still thinking in the mindset of just diversity and not quite stepping into inclusivity and equity. I think we're just starting the inclusivity talks like right now. But moving forward, we have to get back. We have to get to the equity level of things and how can we make it attainable on all levels for everybody, right? And moving beyond that, or moving to that, and then even beyond that, where we're no longer using, where people are no longer having to have their identity be defined on where they come from all the time. Moving just to all of us just being scientists, we have a long way to go for that, for sure. But you know, I'm fairly happy with the progress our field has made in general through time.
It's good. It's nice to hear that, you know, it's, I mean, I think that things are changing, but I'm obviously not of the, kind of people that we're trying to bring in. It might be a woman in science, but you know, that's a different issue, which I will be getting to later.
Yeah, it's all complicated, right? I mean, not complicated. It's all complex, right?
Yeah.
We all have, there's so many different ways to describe people's backgrounds and how people identity politics work will be varied from person to person. And trying to make sure we're helping someone may not seem like you're ignoring another group or things like that. And as long as we all try and remember that we're all trying to work together and move forward together, I think as long as we keep that in mind in general, we're trying our hardest. And then from there, like being like, okay, but for sure, some people are going to need more help than others. Then I think we're going to be okay as long as we're mindful of the complexities of it all. There's no one catch-all solution.
Yeah.
There's not going to turn around in the next year for sure.
Yeah.
So we just need to keep trying.
Well, I think actually that's a great way of finishing off. I think that's really good. So thank you very much, Gabe.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
So now I'm sitting down with Jessica Theodore, who is the vice president of SVP. So thank you very much for joining me, Jessica, and agreeing to talk to me.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
So I guess what I want to get a bit of an idea about is sort of who makes up SVP in terms of demographics, diversity, anything you can tell me about membership would be great.
So the society has, almost 2,300 members, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's more than that. Yeah, no, it's about 2,300 and change. And there's quite a distribution. So about 70% of the society is located in North America.
Mm-hmm.
The largest cohort, of course, is in the United States, followed by Canada, then Mexico within North America. And then the remainder is spread between the EU, UK, and other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular meeting, the attendance is very different, of course, because we have a large Australian contingent at this meeting relative to normal meetings where the Australian component is quite small. Our membership is primarily regular members and student members. So right now we have, as of like, criminy, that's 2013. Let me pull this up further. There's 2019. Yeah, we have about 2,000 members right now.
Mm-hmm.
And of those, 1,165 are regular members.
Mm-hmm.
We currently have almost 500 student members. The transitional early career members is quite small. That's under 100.
Okay.
And then we do have honorary members. There's about 45 of those.
Okay.
And so those are tend to be very senior members who've been honored with honorary membership in the society. And there's a few other categories. So contributing members are ones who donate additional money. There are a couple of developing country members, emeritus members,
mm-hmm.
and so on. So there's a variety of categories. Demographically, the largest group is still the regular membership.
Yeah.
But the student membership is quite large.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at, I don't have the numbers in front of me from the membership chair, because unfortunately the files are not opening. But I do know that demographically speaking, that the among the regular membership, the largest cohort is actually in the baby boomer. And the students, not the young career members, And actually the members of sort of Generation X, my generation, are the smallest cohort in SVP.
Oh, interesting.
Which is going to cause us some interesting challenges in the next few years in terms of dealing with donations and funding some of the things we'd like to do.
Yeah, that's not what I would have expected at all.
So the 90s were a very difficult time to find employment, and we had huge losses of people who left the field.
Yeah. I guess in terms of, since we're talking about diversity, which encompasses more than just that kind of diversity, there isn't much that you guys have in terms of numbers for other types of diversity based on, I mean, it's a hard thing to get numbers on.
It is a rough thing to get numbers on without being really intrusive to the membership. Yeah. And I think there's certainly desire to have better demographic data in terms of members of varying minorities, LGBT, gender identity, but I don't think we're currently doing a great job of capturing that data.
Yeah.
And I think that is something that we do want to do a survey, but we also have to think very carefully about how we want to do that.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the stage we're at with that.
Yeah.
We are certainly trying to expand a lot of opportunities for conversations about diversity. We've moved, we used to have a Women in Paleontology event, which was more of a speakers and less interactive in some ways and very focused on women.
Yeah.
And we've moved away from that more towards a more diverse grouping. So the diversity luncheon addresses way more than just women's issues.
Yeah.
And it's moving really away from the idea that only women should be talking about women's issues.
Yeah.
But talking about issues that face people of color, people, neurodiverse people, mental health issues, stress management, LGBT issues, gender identity issues. So that luncheon has really changed its focus and is trying to address a bunch of different things to provide a safe space for discussion. As a model, it certainly has been useful, I think, and brought up a number of important ideas. The problem is it's also kind of doesn't scale very well. And we often have more people wanting to go to it than we have room for.
Yeah.
So we have to find, we're thinking about different ways we may be able to incorporate other things.
Yeah.
In terms of other aspects of diversity, things that the leadership are moving forward, we have committed to providing childcare at the Cincinnati meeting in 2020. There will be some form of childcare available subsidized by the society, in addition to which the museum has agreed to, I believe, has agreed to try and put on some day camps. They have an active day camp program. So for children, older children, those may be available as well.
That's great.
During the meeting, we have, what else did we talk about this morning? Sorry, I'm just trying to think what we had. We're talking about ways we might be able to improve accessibility for the visually impaired. That's certainly on our radar. There are, I think that's the, those are the main things right in front of my brain at the moment. We're having ongoing discussions about more input, but it's a tricky thing. We did, one of the things we did do a number of years ago now is actually go move to having a standing committee on diversity, right? So we have the diversity committee is now a standing committee and it's chaired by the vice president. And so those issues are getting addressed, and that committee has a diverse, is not just a bunch of white women. It is a more diverse group of people on that committee discussing issues.
So what other things, other than things specifically at the meeting, so you talked about the childcare and the diversity luncheon, what other things do the committee do just kind of as a whole for the society? Are there other initiatives that you guys
So we're trying to figure out ways to bring discussions and or talks around equity and inclusion, diversity issues to the membership without negatively impacting the amount of the scientific program that we present.
Yeah.
We are a scientific society. So we're always kind of balancing those needs. In addition, diversity interacts a lot with education and outreach. And trying, we're trying to find ways to present more to the society without overloading the meeting so far that it becomes unworkable.
Yeah.
During the year, I mean, we're dealing with issues that we're trying to make sure that are useful to the membership, but ultimately the meeting is the big thing that people see.
Yeah.
And an awful lot of the equity and diversity issues that go on that we would like to educate our membership about, it's not so that SVP can fix the world, but so that our members are empowered to take that back to their universities and say, actually, the data show this, and this is what we should be doing.
Yeah.
You know, scientific societies are great, and obviously it's our remit to change what we're doing to improve, but ultimately we're not the only players in the landscape, and universities and museums and scientific outreach organizations also have to do their work here.
Yeah.
And one of the areas, you know, one of the big areas that I think we struggle with is recruiting people of color and Indigenous people into the science.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, you see it just going around the meeting.
Yeah, we're pretty pale.
Yes.
There was we actually had a comedian as a banquet speaker a number of years ago at a meeting who took a look around the banquet hall and said, y'all put the pale in paleontology.
Yeah, it's something I've kind of, you know, thought a lot about over the years, but it's, do you have a sense of whether or not that's unique to paleontology?
No,
or?
I think it's true for a lot of non-medical STEM. It's been my experience that particularly in a lot of minority communities, there's a lot of emphasis on moving into professional careers with financially stable areas, and the pressure that we face in academia with, you know, the difficulties of getting an academic career going, that is a significant area where a lot of parents are like, why would you do this when you can become a doctor? So there's that. There's also just in a lot of cases, there are members of those communities are, and admittedly of you know, non-minority, but first time college students, right? So first in their family, they get a lot of pressure from their parents, and their parents don't understand what an academic career is like or anything about it. And so they don't think of it. Right. I had the luxury of, you know, not having to deal with that because my parents understood, but I know a lot of our members don't. And I see it a lot in my students. So that's a difficult pressure. And there's, you know, there's also frankly a lot of microaggressions that come at people of color, you know, particularly, for example, Black communities, going outdoors, camping, all of that stuff seems to be very, I think they face people who actually are interested in that face some pushback in those communities.
So you have the sort of developing countries memberships and institutional memberships and that kind of thing. Like, I know you give out a membership.
So the we have the memberships for people from developing nations. We have the SE, the new that's one of the other initiatives. So the we have a program for scientists from economically developing nations, an award, and that is being renamed. We've received a substantial donation from John Graff, and it's being renamed the John Graff International Award in Paleontology, which will increase the amount available for those awards so that we can not only bring a paleontologist from a developing nation to the meeting, but also fund them to stay longer to do work, collaborative work, and look at collections in the country that they're traveling to. So that's one of the areas where we're doing
that. That's really great. I hadn't heard anything.
Travel grants, we put aside a lot of extra money and the students raised a lot of extra money for travel grants. And we put, we received some money from Queensland and the Brisbane Economic Development, and we put as much of those towards students from economically developing nations to bring them in.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, it sounds like SVP is trying to do a lot of things to improve kind of diversity and inclusion.
I think we are. I think we struggle the same way that most STEM societies do of finding ways to do it. Because it is a persistent structural problem. And we can do some things. And it's frustrating because I think one of the things that everybody wants us to do is, oh, let's go recruit kids. But if you look at the studies in diversity, it's not recruiting children into science, into STEM, into undergrad, that's the issue.
Yeah.
It's losing them later on.
How to keep them.
And that's a much more persistent and difficult issue than putting on a bunch of programs for kids. Kids love dinosaurs. We have no trouble with that.
Yeah.
But that's not actually going to fix our problem.
No. So I guess kind of wrap up, final question for you. Are you hopeful that things are going to change, that things are improving?
If you compare how things are now with how they were when I started my first SVP in 1988, I can tell you they're already quite different. The pace of change is never going to satisfy everybody, but they are changing. And I think it's greatly improved. Our new code of conduct is a huge leap forward compared to what things were like when I was a student. And the number of people of color at this meeting and the number of women at this meeting are so different from when I began in this field. And I began, you know, I'm not retiring yet.
Yeah.
You know, it is changing. It's just slow enough that you don't notice. And a lot of the younger people don't really realize what it was that like back then.
Yeah. Well, that's great. It's good to know that you can see the changes as you've been going through. So that's fantastic. Thanks for sitting down with me, Jessica.
You're very welcome.
PaleoCast was brought to you by Dave Marshall and Liz Martin-Silverstone, with contributions from Tom Fletcher, Vish Venkat, and Elsa Pancharoli. Music was composed by Patrick Kendall-Smith. PaleoCast was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on funding from you, the listeners. So, if you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programs, and follow us across social media platforms to get all the latest news. Finally, if you enjoy our podcast, then please explore all of our video content on YouTube and follow our other projects, the Virtual Natural History Museum and the PaleoCast Gaming Network.